Navigating the teen years can be challenging for anyone. For teenagers who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or struggling to understand their sexuality, the risks are even greater. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, Ryan Berg spent several years working with homeless LGBTQ youth in New York City. He's written about his experiences and the experiences of the young people he tried to help in the book No House to Call My Home. I'll talk with him, and Penny McGee of Iowa Kids Net will be here, and we'll talk about how the foster care system in Iowa is working to meet the needs of LGBTQ youth. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. More than 4,000 youth are homeless in New York City. 43% of them identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or questioning. LGBTQ youth are also overrepresented in Iowa's foster care system. Later in the hour, we'll talk about how the foster care system in Iowa is working to meet the needs of these at-risk young people. But we'll start with those scary numbers from New York City. Ryan Berg grew up in West Des Moines, but he spent several years working with homeless LGBTQ youth in New York City. He's written about his experiences and the experiences of the young people he tried to help in the book No House to Call My Home, and he is here with me today. Hello, Ryan.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, tell us a little bit about your story. I mentioned you lived in West Des Moines. What took you to New York City?
Sure. I started as a theater student at the University of Iowa, moved to San Francisco, moved to Italy, and then I ended up in New York and was doing theater there for a number of years. And I just became kind of upset about the conversation being so limited within that world and felt like I needed to do something greater than for myself. And I really just got online and looked for a job. I found one dealing with LGBT youth. And really had no idea what I was about to get into.
And you didn't have a social work background or a counseling background. This was something that you just sort of plunged into.
Right. So unfortunately, in the world of social work, there's a scarcity of competent workers and there's a need for competent workers. So it seems like if you have a good heart, a bachelor's degree, and the want and willingness to care, you can jump into that field.
Well, I would love for you to read just a couple pages from the book, which really introduces us to one of the group homes that you spent time working in, a group home called Keep Street. Could you read us a little bit?
Of course. The group home is called Keep Street. It houses gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youth in foster care and is one of only a handful of such programs in New York City. These kids are anywhere from 14 to 21 years old, all of them Black or Latino. They've been placed in care because they were either neglected or abused by their parents or because their behavior was considered unmanageable in their homes. Most of them are here because when their sexual orientation or gender identity was discovered, they were again abused by someone at a former group home or thrown out by a foster parent. There are 12 residents. I read all of their case files prior to meeting them. When we met, I tried to connect their faces to their stories. Maddie is 16 with long black hair. She styles herself in a tough way that is contradicted by her eyes. Her heroin-addicted mother died of AIDS when she was 9, and her father was murdered in a gang dispute when she was 8. Junior, his birth name is Shaden, is 19 years old, an immigrant from Jamaica. He was placed in care by the courts because he was deemed a thief and a liar. He was raised with 5 siblings in a one-bedroom apartment in the Bronx, and tells people that he's a doctor with houses in Long Island in Florida. Deanna, called Crush because she crushes so hard on the girls, was placed at the home after a stint in the juvenile detention center for lifting some sneakers for a shorty she was crushing on. In detention, she got in trouble for flirting with one of the girls, whose boyfriend found out and hit Crush in the head with a brick. Now she has periodic epileptic seizures. Nothing happened to the boy, but Crush was labeled a sexual predator and removed from the facility. Now she's in love with Fashima, who has a trusting face and dimpled smile. Fashima has to rely on sex to survive in the streets, and she uses her body in the group home to manipulate the other residents, namely Crush. pimpled face and slinky, Christina is a cocoa-colored 16-year-old transgender Latina from the Bronx who thinks she's a white girl from the suburbs. Her Britney Spears infatuation is all-consuming. 19-year-old Raheem, thin and attractive with full pouty lips, was put into care because he was sexually abused by his father and then by his foster parents. Both his mother and father have since died. He's threatened to kill other residents and himself on more than one occasion. Kara Dad is squat and stout. She prides herself on not being ghetto. She rejects the other residents' fashion style, Sean Johns, Timberlands, academics. Instead, she goes for anything black and adorned with skulls. Her hair changes color as often as her mood ring. On the day I met her, she had a 4-inch nail jutting out from beneath her bottom lip. I read that in her case file that she's a cutter, and as we talked, I saw that her arms were dotted with tiny sliver scars.
It's Ryan Berg reading from his book, No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. It's about the years that he spent working with LGBTQ youth in New York City. And Ryan, we already talked about the fact that you didn't have a background in social work or training to really work with people with the kinds of problems that these kids were facing. In the group home, what were your responsibilities?
Well, I started as a residential counselor, which means I lived with the youth from Wednesday until Friday. I'd come in Wednesday morning and I would stay straight through until Friday night. So I was really tasked with helping them with daily chores, working on their schedules, making sure they made appointments, getting to school, kind of a parental role, I would say, mixed in with some non-clinical kind of counseling, dealing with personal issues and interpersonal issues within the home. And then as a case manager later on, I was tasked with helping them meet their personal goals and also goals of the program. Foster care is very kind of prescriptive in that respect, where it's, the youth don't really have much say, but it's really about the goals that the program puts forth for the youth. So that typically is around education, and it's around long-term housing after foster care and employment.
And you mentioned after foster care, the young people you were working with age out of the system in New York at age 21.
Right. It's 21 in New York, and throughout the country, I think the average age would probably be 18. We know that most young people, regardless of being in foster care or not, are not ready to be independent at age 18 or 21. And then, unfortunately, across the country, you'll find that many of those young people who have come through foster care end up homeless. There are nearly half the homeless youth that are in this country have come through the foster care system at one point or another.
The young people that you were working with, I think a lot of us maybe naively think about a group home as kind of a safe place. And the young people you were working with, this is where they slept. This is where they ate. This was their home base. But
correct,
they were also out there in the world.
Right. So many young people come into foster care. Foster care is created with protecting our young people who have been either removed from homes because of neglect or abuse or for other various reasons. The general population group home, it's not really a safe spot for LGBT youth, primarily because of the institutional legacy of systemic failure around providing informed guidance for staff workers and for foster parents. There's just a lot of kind of misinformation and the folks that are uneducated on the subjects and the issues that young people face. So in New York, I was working at a home that was specifically for LGBT youth because we know that in general population homes, they experienced a lot of violence, a lot of discrimination around their identity. So a lot of the youth in New York that I was working with had already lived in some capacity in the streets. They found ways to survive on the streets. Our job was really around trying to help them stabilize, feel safe, and then hopefully normalize some patterns of behavior in order to become healthy, thriving adults.
A lot of the young people that you were working with, and this was mentioned a little bit in the passage that you read, but a number of them either had been engaged in prostitution or occasionally engaged in prostitution actively while you were working with them. So that was an issue that wasn't something you could really tackle within the youth home.
No. See, what typically happens with youth, primarily trans youth of color, but also it was common within the young gay male population, was survival sex. Young people trading sex for either food or shelter before coming into the foster home, and then that behavior, you know, becomes normalized within their lives, and it's hard. It's a hard cycle to break. Yeah, many young people would be trafficked, and a lot of young people would be doing this on their own in order to get money. A lot of trans youth are unable to find legitimate work because of their identity. They face a ton of discrimination. The unemployment rates for trans women is astronomical. It's I think it's somewhere like 30%. I'm not quite sure at this point, but it's ridiculous. And so they have to resort to other behaviors in order to survive on the streets.
You also were working with a number of young people who had serious drug problems as well.
Right. So many youth who come through foster care are dealing with a ton of trauma in their lives, and they find ways to cope. And some ways that they're coping are not necessarily safe or, you know, would want them to be partaking in long term. Drug addiction, substance use and abuse was very common. It's a way to self-medicate and not deal with the emotional kind of trauma and baggage that comes from experiencing a lot of the issues that they came with through neglect and abuse within the home. One of the issues that we deal with within the foster care world is substance abuse, and we use a harm reduction model around that. We know that, you know, this has been a coping mechanism for a lot of young people, and to tell them that we're taking away a coping mechanism can be further traumatizing. So we try to find ways to slowly adjust behavior so it becomes healthier.
But it also creates a major safety concern within the home. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. But you shared stories of times when there would be one resident who had been smoking crack or something like that and then came home and was dangerous for the other residents.
Correct. You definitely want to make sure that all the residents are safe and taken care of. And so when issues do arise like that, it becomes a great concern. And you also find that youth, because they're they consider that group a family, that they come up and try to rally with that person who's struggling in that moment.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Ryan Berg. He's the author of No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. He wrote the book about the time that he spent working with homeless LGBTQ youth in New York City. We'll also talk about foster care in Iowa and this at-risk population. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the special risks, the special challenges that lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or questioning youth face in foster care with regard to homelessness. This hour, my guests are Ryan Berg. He's an Iowa native and author of No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. And also joining us now is Penny McGee. She's statewide recruitment leader for Iowa KidsNet. She herself has been a foster mom, and she's an advocate for youth that face these challenges. Penny, hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And we were talking earlier, I threw out one of those statistics that Ryan has in his book. About 4,000 youth are homeless in New York City. 43% of them identify as LGBTQ. And so that's self-identification. And if we assume that somewhere between 5 and 15% of the population is part of that group, I mean, that's a huge overrepresentation of LGBTQ youth in homelessness in New York City. In Iowa, in foster care, I understand that there is a higher percentage of these kids who wind up in foster care as well, not maybe that high a percentage. But what do we know about how at risk these young people are?
You know, we don't have hard data for Iowa because it hasn't been gathered. So we have to really extrapolate our known factors from national studies that have been done. And there have been several national studies that have indicated just in the child welfare system in general, somewhere between 18% and 20% of the total youth population will identify as LGBTQ. So our known factors in Iowa are about how many kids annually are in the child welfare system. And then I also like to add in the juvenile justice system. Often those youth are intersectionally involved with both systems of care. But in one particular fiscal year in Iowa, fiscal year 2012, we had 10,312 youth that were involved with the child welfare system. And they're broken out. You can break them out kind of according to age range. So maybe a third of those youth would be ages 0 to 5, and maybe a third would be ages 5 to 10 or 5 to 12, and then a third of those youth would be 13 and older. So we can just from that say somewhere between 18 and 20% of those youth are going to identify as LGBTQ. And so what, you know, we talk a lot now about kind of the school-to-prison pipeline for youth of color. But what we see sometimes, I think, with LGBTQ youth is kind of a school-to-homelessness pipeline. Oftentimes, early on, they start facing bullying and intimidating environments in the school system that may carry over in the home environment. Or there may be other issues happening in the home that have nothing to do with their identity that caused them to be removed from their home or choose voluntarily to leave their home or kicked out. And then once they arrive in the child welfare system or the juvenile justice system, right now we have a system that never factored these youth into account. I don't think it was overt bias. I think it just was a real lack of awareness that we have LGBTQ youth actively involved in our systems of care. So there really never were any policies or legislation written around protecting them once they became involved in these systems of care.
Well, and I can imagine that there are a lot of challenges for the people who are trying to help these young people, because taking a child's sexuality into account when trying to help them somehow seems fundamentally wrong.
Sure. But I think, you know, that is part of beginning to address some of the gaps in our systems is overcoming some of that mythology. I think we tend to think that younger kids, you know, at age 12 or 13 can't possibly have a formed sexual orientation or gender identity. Well, in fact, we know that kids from very early on know their gender identity. I have 3-year-old twins, and they are very clear about their gender identity. But we know now that kids tend to start identifying a sexual orientation around age 10, and they start tending to self-identify or maybe even possibly disclose that identity around age 13, so younger maybe than we've ever seen before. But the reason that they've remained invisible for so long is we haven't asked the question. We haven't asked youth how they identify. We still don't ask the question. And there's a small number of youth who feel safe enough and confident enough and are skilled enough, especially after facing abuse and trauma and neglect, who will readily self-disclose an identity. So one of my urgent calls to people involved in the system is that we need to treat all youth as if they could be LGBTQ.
Now, Ryan, you tell in your book personal stories of a number of young people, and listening to Penny talk about sort of this 10 to 13 year old age range, when you looked into the stories and you got to know these young people and learned about their past, was there a certain timeline where things seemed to start coming to a crisis point for these young people?
With the youth that I worked with, particularly in New York, at the LGBT group home, you know, they were either in foster care early, not so much due to sexual orientation or gender identity. There were other predictors that would lead to that, family trauma, generational poverty, substance abuse within the family, and whatnot. But when their sexual identity or gender identity, sexual orientation or gender identity came out, they were either in a foster home or in a group home. And that's where a lot of the issues really started to come up within the system for them, because they were then facing a ton of discrimination and a lot of violence.
Now, Penny, with foster parents, the last time you were on this program, we were talking about some of the challenges that we face in Iowa, because predominantly we have Caucasian foster parents, where we have an increasingly diverse group of children who need foster care, and some of the challenges that are created that way. And that's something that you have worked hard, and many others have also worked hard, to recruit foster parents of color, but also to prepare families for differences, for challenges that might arise with LGBT young people. Is there part of the preparation for foster parents that includes the idea that, hey, this is something that you might need to support your child through?
Sure. That's something that foster parent candidates are required to go through, a 30-hour pre-service training. And that's something that's recently, within the last couple of years, been added into the curriculum, is the discussion around possibly caring for a youth who might identify as gender nonconforming or LGBTQ. And so there's some exercises built around that. But I think sometimes what families don't maybe understand is prior to the time of a youth being placed in their home, they probably aren't going to know how that youth identifies. Again, the youth may not have disclosed to anybody what their identity is. And maybe in the foster home might hopefully feel safe enough to disclose that for the first time. But there are a lot of foster families who they may have faith beliefs that would prevent them from being affirming towards this identity, or they just may have had a lack of known exposure to LGBTQ youth. And so they feel uncomfortable and uncertain around this issue. And some of them still face those old beliefs that LGBTQ youth might influence other kids in the house, their own children, et cetera. So we try to overcome that and educate folks as best we can through the training process. One of the, I'll call it kind of a gap in our system, is that if folks identify that they can't or won't care for an LGBTQ identified youth, that's great. I'm glad folks are disclosing that, because I wouldn't then want to place a youth who's known to be LGBTQ in that environment. However, because a youth's identity isn't known typically prior to the time of placement, I think we're potentially exposing a lot of kids to some hostile or possibly discriminatory environments, where they're hearing some negative messaging around identity, which further traumatizes them, even when their identity isn't known to anybody but them.
I agree, and I'd like to add to that, but a lot of youth don't even – haven't come to terms with their identity. Maybe they're still – you know, it's that identity is still forming, so they might not even be recognizing themselves in that way until maybe they're in a home. So the idea of an affirming home regardless is so important, because we want to make sure that they don't have a shame-based existence, that they are being affirmed regardless of their identity.
We're talking about the challenges that LGBTQ youth face in Iowa and elsewhere this hour. My guest's Ryan Berg. He's an Iowa native and author of No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. And Penny McGee, who's statewide recruitment leader for Iowa KidsNet. She's also been a foster mother in the past. And now, Penny, I want to kind of flesh out this problem a little bit, because we have a tremendous need for foster parents in Iowa, and whether or not a home works or not, we know that the vast majority of people who step forward and say, hey, I want to be a foster parent, they have good intentions. You're constantly trying to recruit foster parents. So this must be an incredibly sticky problem when you have people coming into the foster care system who might not be able to adequately care for a child with these needs.
It is. It's a point of personal and professional conflict. I think because of my own belief systems, it does become difficult, because I see the need and the greater risk and the poorer outcomes for LGBTQ youth. But also, I have a great desire to respect people's personal faith traditions and their belief systems. So it is a point of conflict. I think the best I can do is try to overcome that, I think, societal tendency to make assumptions that are just based on our own worldview. So again, going back to, we have to treat every youth as if they could be something other than what we believe they are.
Now, until recently, that hasn't even been really a part of the conversation. Have those questions become more of a part of the conversation in your recruitment process?
Absolutely. We have a very aggressive recruitment campaign, really devoted to raising public awareness around this issue, but also inviting folks who are affirming in their own everyday lives to consider becoming foster and adoptive parents. And if that's not a place that they're in their lives, possibly being a mentor, getting involved in some other way for youth who identify as LGBTQ. But beyond that, you know, we really just try to our overall foster parent capacity. We have a long way to go in terms of elevating the discussion and creating more awareness and more education around this topic.
Well, and we've talked about this in the past, but just remind us of the tremendous need and the challenges that you face in recruiting enough families.
Sure. We have so many youth all across Iowa who are in need of a foster home. Sometimes it's very short term, a weekend or a week. Sometimes it's much longer term. And we have a difficult time. We not only have to recruit enough foster families to meet the influx of children and youth entering the system every year, and that can fluctuate anywhere between 4,000 and 6,000 youth entering the foster care system every year. But we also have the youth that are in homes for multiple years. And we have foster parents who retire every year, who close out their license and find a different way to get involved with serving youth, mostly after years of service. So we not only have to continue to increase the number we bring in, we have to replace the pool of folks that we're losing every year. So it's a constant uphill climb, pushing a square boulder up a mountain.
Well, and the youth that you write about, Ryan, are all teenagers or in their early 20s. And now in Iowa, I believe foster children age out of the system at age 18. So, Penny, when placing teenagers, I mean, that's an incredible challenge in and of itself, because teenagers are challenging. All kinds of teenagers are challenging. So that creates yet another problem for recruiting parents, right?
Absolutely. A lot of folks, particularly if they haven't worked with teens or haven't parented teens before, teens, for some reason, can be considered scary. I would challenge anybody who thinks a teen is scary to deal with my 3-year-old child's tantrums, and then they would welcome a teen, I think, give or take. So, yeah, not only do we have a difficult time placing just overall youth, but then we're really talking about kind of a niche population when we're talking about LGBTQ youth. So the challenges, I think, are twice as hard.
And Ryan, do you, in the young people that you worked with, does New York City, is it a magnet for some of these young people who are struggling with their sexual identity? Because I know that New York City has sort of a mythology around it. It may be a place to run away to. And I know that running away is a problem that a lot of these young people face as they're trying to get out of bad situations. Was that something that you observed?
Sure. I think, you know, there's kind of this history of migration for LGBT youth finding a safe space and assumed safe spaces. I think, you know, a lot of young people find themselves going to cities that they are unfamiliar with, and then they're becoming disconnected from whatever tenuous supports they may have had initially. So, yeah, in New York, I definitely came across young people who had been removed from whatever relationships they had because of that migration. I think what we're finding now is that, you know, yeah, New York, L.A., San Francisco are still big draws for LGBT youth. But we're also finding mid-sized cities to be draws as well. I live in Minneapolis now, and I work with homeless youth, and we're finding that youth are coming here from Wisconsin, from Iowa, from the Dakotas, because of it being fairly close in proximity and having a reputation for support. But it does have that, but it also leaves these young people disconnected, trying to navigate a system in a city that they're unfamiliar with, and then becoming, exposed to predators. We know that young people who are experiencing homelessness within the first 48 hours will be approached by someone who wants to exploit them.
That percentage that I've mentioned a couple of times, 43% of homeless youth identify as LGBTQ in New York City. Would you say from your observations in other places that that's a pretty standard percentage across the board when you look at the homeless population in the Twin Cities, for example?
Sure. Well, as Kai mentioned, a lot of statistics are kind of self-reported. So I just did a book tour across the country and kind of asked that if that statistic was relevant to the particular community I was in. And I was finding that in Philadelphia, in Atlanta, the numbers are higher than 50%.
Wow.
Because a lot of youth don't want to self-identify, and these statistics oftentimes are coming from direct care workers who are making assumptions, that young people don't want to self-identify out of fear of discrimination, rejection, or violence. So we're finding that it's hard to pinpoint exact numbers, but we're finding that it's definitely near 50%.
I'm talking with Ryan Berg. He's the author of No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. Also here this hour, Penny McGee, statewide recruitment leader for Iowa KidsNet. We're talking about the challenges that young people who are part of the LGBTQ community face in foster care with regard to homelessness. We'll talk more in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about some of the special challenges that face young people in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or questioning community. With me today, Ryan Berg. He is an Iowa native. He's an author of No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions, a book he wrote about the LGBTQ youth he worked with in New York City who were homeless or in foster care. Also with me this hour is Penny McGee, statewide recruitment leader for Iowa KidsNet. We've been talking about some of the challenges that LGBTQ youth face in foster care in Iowa. And Penny, I want to talk about a new advocacy program that you are a part of that's called Affirm. Can you tell us what the goal of Affirm is?
Sure. Affirm is a coalition of different organizations and entities that came together specifically around this issue of needing some reform in the child welfare system and the juvenile justice system, specifically on behalf of LGBTQ youth, because there's such a lack of policies in place to deal with these youth in a sensitive and competent manner, because there are very few protections built into place. Despite being, in many of our laws, a very progressive state, this is an area that's been left unaddressed for many years. So our coalition is really hoping to take up that cause. And there are some pretty easy solutions to some of these problems. Other problems are larger and need systemic change. Our organization is looking at doing what we can to advocate for and implement all of the changes necessary.
Well, give me an idea of some of those simpler changes that you are advocating for.
Sure. I think it starts with asking the question, even for, foster parent or adoptive parent candidates. Right now, a lot of our state documentation that foster parents and adoptive parents have to fill out, rather than saying, say, applicant one or applicant two, we'll still say mother, father. So still coming from a very heterosexual assuming kind of format. So just changing some of that paperwork allows people to start asking the question of how do you identify so that I'm not making assumptions. That would go a long way towards helping. And identity right now in Iowa is not required to be a factor in placement decisions. So in the rare instances when a youth is skilled enough and brave enough to disclose their identity as LGBTQ to a social worker or a juvenile court person, that identity is not required to be a factor in their placement. So the youth can ask for an affirming placement or an affirming foster home, but there's no requirement that that be taken into account.
Although a social worker could choose to do that at this point.
Sure. A social worker certainly, and most do, choose to honor that request when they can. The problem is that in the exceptions where we have so few foster homes and fewer just overall beds in shelters and group care facilities available in Iowa, sometimes you just need the first available roof, and whether or not it's an affirming place is kind of the last thing on your mind. Yeah.
Well, and the information about whether this would be an affirming home or not that's not always available. Right.
Sure. It is hopefully now. Okay. That's part of the foster parent screening, the home study process, is that's one of the topics of discussion in that evaluation process. So hopefully we're doing a better job now of collecting that information. But of course, when it comes to juvenile detention facilities or group care facilities, again, there's no state legislature or policy that requires agencies that contract with the state to have affirming policies and practices. So it's really left up to individual group care agencies to decide if they want to implement LGBTQ affirming policies and practices. And what we find is some do. They're doing the best they can to implement what they think should be done. And others still fail, I think, a lot of times to recognize that they are dealing with LGBTQ clients, even if they don't think they are. And so they don't yet feel a need to put in place policies and procedures. So in foster care, we can do a better job of trying to assure an affirming home. But in other facilities and service providers, we can't.
Now, when you're talking about changing the forms that foster parents fill out, that doesn't sound like something that would take a legislative change. Who can decide that? And what is it going to take if your group succeeds at getting someone to make that change?
Sure. To get state documents changed oftentimes does require some sort of legislative approval or human services oversight to approve. And then, of course, there's budgetary concerns because all of the documents have to subscribe to Iowa Code and Iowa Administrative Law. So It is a little bit more complicated than it should seem. It should seem like you can get in the computer and change the wording and call it good, but it's a little more complicated than that.
As far as legislative changes that would need to take place, what are your priorities?
I would like specifically to see non-discrimination factors with teeth written into all of the state policies around caring for our most vulnerable kids. Full implementation of the Prison Rape Elimination Act in all of our juvenile court and juvenile detention centers, and a requirement to at the very least operate in a non-discriminatory manner.
I want to ask you, Ryan, when you were describing the group homes that you worked in, one of the things that struck me, so many things struck me. One of them was that more than once you mentioned that one of the young people you were working with had been in another group home that was not specifically designated for LGBTQ youth. And because they were in a phase of sexual exploration, they ended up being identified as a sexual predator. That sounds like a tremendous danger for these young people, because a lot of homes, foster homes or group homes, are gender segregated. And yet with these young people, that doesn't work the same way.
Right. Yeah. Many youth, and this was 2004 to 2006 when the events in the book took place. In New York, there have been laws and best practices legislation that has gone into play. So right now in New York, anyone who works for the state in foster care, volunteers, contract workers, all providers have to it's in the book that they can't discriminate and that there's no harassment of young people based off of perceived sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. So that has changed in New York. It's one of the few states. But yeah, before that, a lot of young people were subject to discrimination around their sexual orientation, and this kind of miseducation or people who are uneducated on sexual orientation and affirming one's identity would label a young person. And then, you know, if they do go through the court system and they are labeled a sexual predator, that follows them through their whole lives. And with one, I think one person you may be thinking of in particular, who I call Benny in the book, who was just a young adolescent who was exploring sexual urges with another young person. It just a kind of innocent kind of exploration that all young people go through. And he was happened to be in a residential setting at the time, and staff walked in, and then he was taken to court and shipped down south and labeled a sexual predator. So, you know, these things do still happen across the country, unfortunately.
Penny, that must be an incredible challenge for the foster care system, too, because, again, I mean, gender segregation is something that we've relied on in the past to minimize some of the challenges and some of the dangers for young people when they're going through this difficult time. How do you cope with it in this case?
I think, you know, this is where those best practices, those policies and procedures really come into play, and where they're still missing in many cases. We right now require gender segregation and bedroom sharing for kids over the age of six in foster care. And obviously for transgender youth, that's going to look a little bit different. In our congregate care facilities of whatever type they may be, it's typically they're placed based on their gender assigned at birth rather than how they're currently identifying, even if they've begun the process of medically transitioning. And so we see variations from youth placed in isolation. Typically, it's usually said to be for their own protection. Or we see, you know, that they're placed in an inappropriate setting where they are placed with a similar gender according to their gender assigned at birth, but they face more harassment, discrimination, and risk for sexual violence. And oftentimes youth aren't afforded the option of having private shower facilities or, you know, private hygiene restroom facilities. In our detention facilities, youth are typically required to undergo a search, you know, a physical search of their body to make sure that they don't have anything dangerous with them. We would like to see particularly transgender youth be able to select the gender of the staff performing the search to try to make that process more comfortable for them. And these are things that just require awareness and then policies written around that.
Now, Ryan is writing about homeless youth. He's writing about youth in foster care. In Iowa, what do we know about the homeless youth population in the state?
Sure. I think it's a really invisible population for the most part, and it's notoriously hard to collect data. Ryan spoke to that point on homeless youth in general. And then you have to agree on a definition of homeless. So you have homeless unaccompanied youth, you have sheltered and unsheltered youth, you have youth who are couch surfing, so they would qualify as homeless even if they have a place to sleep that night. So in terms of hard data, I think it's really difficult. But I think particularly in our larger urban communities, I think the homeless youth population is much higher, to the tune of several thousand than we would believe it is. I think in Iowa we'd like to believe that's probably below 1,000. And I think that's a gross underestimation.
Where does that denial come from in your view?
Gosh, that's a good question.
I mean, why don't we see it? I'm sure that many school counselors are nodding their heads and saying, yes, I know about this population, or many other people who work with these at-risk young people are aware. But where does that awareness disconnect with awareness at a higher level?
Sure. I think as a whole, I think we as a society tend to assume that somebody's taking care of it. Somebody's addressing this issue, you know. But I think, too, this goes to a lot of our youth who are going to great pains to stay invisible. They don't want to come to the attention of the system or authorities. So they specifically are taking measures to make sure that they aren't found or accounted for. We have such a high dropout rate among homeless youth. You know, the risk of suicide or suicidal attempts, the risk of substance abuse, all of it is much higher for homeless youth. And I just think that it's just one of those things we like to think it's not happening here, not in our state, not in our communities, not in our schools.
Ryan, you've been on a book tour talking to many people about these issues. I know you continue to do work with young people in this community in the Twin Cities. What are your priorities? What are you hoping will come out of this book and higher profile conversations about these problems?
Right. I'm hoping to educate folks and to hopefully start a conversation in places where conversations aren't happening around this issue. I find it incredibly infuriating that we are turning our backs on our young people who need support and guidance and affirming places to live. And I'm hoping to evoke some change and also to create space for the young people to speak for themselves. I think it's incredibly important. They're the experts in this field. They're the ones who know what's happening. I think Kai spoke to many issues that we're dealing with in Minnesota. We have over 4,000 young people who are experiencing homelessness on any given night. Many of them are under the radar. I think that's an issue across the board, is that a lot of young people don't want to identify as homeless and don't identify as homeless because of the stereotype that's associated with that, the negative kind of connotation and stereotype of the smelly man standing on the street corner in his mid-years. So I think a lot of young people don't see themselves as that, and rightfully so. And there's a difference between a young person who's experiencing housing instability and new to homelessness versus chronic homelessness within our communities. I think the point of the book really is to point out that this issue of that our young people are facing, it's really at no fault of their own. They are experiencing systems that are particularly broken and don't work for them. So we have to do what we can as a community to step up for our young people and provide those supports.
Charity, if I can, I'd like to offer that one of the reasons that I really became personally involved in this issue is when I started researching to find out really what was happening. One of the national studies, and I think it's been replicated since then, indicated that of the youth that were surveyed at the time, about 78% of those youth indicated that they had either forced a removal or ran away from a foster care setting because of the hostility and discrimination they faced in that foster care setting. And an overwhelming number of those kids indicated they felt safer living on the streets than they did living in group care or foster care. To me, you know, that's that school to foster care or juvenile detention to homelessness pipeline that we're talking about. It's just incredibly troubling that when a youth most needs a safe place, they can't find it.
Exactly. And the biggest reason for youth coming into juvenile justice system, LGBT youth coming in, is family rejection. That's the greatest predictor.
And Penny, since the last time you and I talked, this Affirm coalition has been formed. Are you feeling optimistic about positive change being made in this front?
I'm feeling incredibly optimistic. I think we have more and more leaders in the public sector who are becoming more aware of this issue and are willing to do something about it. It wasn't that they were biased or ill-intentioned to begin with. It was just simply a lack of awareness. They hadn't had the reason or the opportunity to be exposed to this discussion. And so I'm the eternal optimist, and I believe once they do become aware that these changes will be implemented.
Penny McGee, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Penny McGee is statewide recruitment leader for Iowa KidsNet. She's also involved with the Affirm Coalition. And Ryan Berg, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ryan Berg grew up in West Des Moines. He's the author of No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. It's a book about the work that he did in youth in group homes for LGBTQ youth in New York City for 2 years, stories of those young people and the challenges that they face. Talk of Iowa is produced by Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We'd love to hear from you, your suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show, your responses to things you hear on the show. Send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.